on the model that we've been concentrating on these people. And I wanted to make this more in the spirit of a CAPRA workshop, where people interrupt and ask questions all the time. I know this is a big room and we are sort of intimidated by the dimensions, but feel free to interrupt, okay? So I was asked to give a bridge talk. And so the idea here is to connect communities that speak more or less different languages. So it might be difficult to for some people to understand when Salesforce people discuss dissipative effects versus conservative effects. So my solution to this is to use very sketchy math and be very imprecise and vague and, you know, dazzle you with PowerPoint tricks. And I'm sure everybody's going to be happy about that. But, you know, details can be seen in the papers if you want. And you can ask me questions. Now, how do we define an embry? So here we have two compact objects, one that's much smaller than the other. So for example, a 10 solar mass black hole going around a much more massive black hole. So the mass ratios are 10 to the minus 4 and smaller than that, or those are the ones that we like to consider. The MBH, or the massive black hole, or the supermassive black hole, should be a spinning curve background, at least in GR. And you should allow any spins, of course. The small compact object, or the small particle, can be spinning or non-spinning. In this talk, I'm going to concentrate on a non-spinning small particle. But it should be allowed to be in a completely generic orbit, which means you should have complete relativistic motion. Now, in black hole perturbation theory, this presents a beautiful perturbation scheme because the mass ratio is a small parameter that remains small during the entire evolution. So you can expand your differential equations in the mass ratio to first order or second order. However, since you should allow for completely relativistic motion, you should not necessarily be expanding in V, the velocity of the, or the orbital velocity. From a data analysis point of view, we have very, very long signals, essentially limited by the time of observation of our instrument. And on top of that, they're very, very weak. So Alberto was saying that they were considering systems with SNRs between 10 and 50 or so. And on top of that, most of that is an arc, or essentially all of that is an arc, comes from the in spiral. You have about a million radians in this 1 year in spiral, and all of the power is contained in that regime. The merger and ring down, unlike in the equal mass case, don't really contribute that much to embryos. So this is nice from an analytic point of view because it means that we don't have to worry too much about complications that arise during the merger phase, for example, of equal mass black holes or the ring. But it does lead to complications because we have to maintain coherence for about a million radians or more. So the question I want to address in this talk is the following. So imagine that Lisa were to fly tomorrow. So what would we do? Well, after celebrating, we would try to analyze the data obtained with different waveforms, particularly for embryos. And we might want to do it coherently or not. We might want to divide the data set into little chunks and analyze them separately, like Alberto was saying, and then connecting them together. But the question is, what waveforms do we use? And a not-so-secret secret is that we do have waveforms. And those are the ones I'm going to try to summarize in this talk, at least some of them. But whatever model you use, you should at least satisfy the following two requirements. One, it should be accurate. That means it should be at least one radian accurate relative to your exact solution, whatever your exact solution is. And this is a very difficult statement to verify, because since we don't have an exact solution for what the embry motion and the embry waveforms are going to be, we don't really know how to assess whether something's accurate or not. So we have to compare against other approximations, and that intrinsically leads to systematic errors. So we have to be careful about that. However, this is a requirement we should keep in mind. Furthermore, we want something that's fast and efficient, because our parameter space can be very large. We're going to need many templates, estimates for how many templates we need for embryos, for generic orbits, range in the billions. So we cannot afford a method that takes too long to produce a single template. Now, For the remaining of this talk, I'm going to describe some of these models that introduce or reintroduce Skywalker classification of these models. Then move on to the EOB model that we've been discussing. Hopefully, I'll convince you that EOB rocks. And then from then on, we're going to compare that EOB model to the so-called adiabatic approximation that I'm also going to describe. So in general, how do you define a model? Well, whenever you have a model, you have the trajectories of your emrys and the gravitational waves generated by these trajectories. So the trajectories can be described in terms of a geodesic motion that's being corrected by some force, if you'd like, or you can think of it this way at least, a force, a sort of pushing on this particle, moving it away from geodesic motion. And there's two approaches to model this force. Here's where the Skywalker classification comes in, because there's a Jedi path, which would be to compute the full cell force, which reduces to solving the linearized Einstein equations in some specific gauge and so on. But of course, there are other approaches that allow you to push this geodesic via an approximation of what that cell force should be. Once you have the trajectories, what do you do with them? Well, you try to solve the Einstein equations. Now, the Einstein equations acting on some background, say the Kerr background and a small perturbation, are going to be sourced by the small object stress energy tensor, which depends on the trajectories of the bodies. So you can see this equation and the equation up here are coupled. And some sort of decoupling needs to happen in order to be able to solve the problem. But eventually, you do it by inverting the Einstein tensor. And again, the solution to this equation, you can approach in two different ways. A Jedi way, an accurate way, is to just go and solve the cost equation to first order. A less accurate way is to use some sort of expansion or approximation to solve the linearized Einstein equations. Okay? So keeping this in mind, we can define different models. Well, the first model would be to model or describe the trajectories in terms of geodesics with a cell force that continuously update this geodesic so that you are essentially, the trajectory gets continuously updated from one geodesic to the next as described by the cell force essentially. And that trajectory is then used to solve the Tsiolkovsky equation, for example. Another model is what Carlos described on Sunday, where many of you weren't here, but here the idea is to, instead of using the full cell force, is to use an approximate version of the cell force. As for the way for modeling, instead of solving the Tsiolkovsky equation exactly, you would do a Posse-Minkowskian expansion, where a Posse-Minkowskian expansion here is an expansion in the strength of the gravitational field, G, if you'd like. Now, I'm not going to describe this again because Carlos already talked about it on Sunday. The model I want to describe here in more detail is this post-Newtonian effective one-body approach, where the trajectories are modeled via solutions of the Hamiltonian equations with some prescription for your radiation reaction force or your cell force, also in an approximate fashion. And then the waveforms is constructed via resampled polar decomposition. I'm sorry, Steve, I don't have your method here, but I didn't know you were working on this, so my bad. However, there are two other models that, three other models that I want to discuss. One of them is this so-called adiabatic or radiative approximation that Eric at some level worked on a long time ago, and then Scott and Steve pushed further together with other people. Here, the idea is that you're going to imagine your trajectory as a sequence of geodesics. So if you imagine your orbital phase space defined, say, by your initial conditions, like the initial separation or the initial eccentricity and so on, this defines a point in your orbital phase space, which defines a geodesic. Now, at that point, you solve the Tsiolkovsky equation, and you find how much gravitational waves are being emitted by that geodesic. And the solution to the Tsiolkovsky equation then lets you compute how your orbital elements are changing. So in this orbital phase space picture, it gives you a little vector in your orbital phase space, so you can go from one point to the next. So then you repeat this, and you essentially connect the dots through the vectors in your orbital phase space, thus obtaining the trajectory. Of course, you also get the waveforms automatically, because at each point you computed what the waveform was, so then you can just interpret it. lacking an exact solution, what we're going to compare the EOB approach to is going to be this adiabatic approximation, or sorry, this radiative approximation, instead of the full cell force, since we don't quite have waveforms yet. Now, as I was saying earlier, there are two other approaches, the so-called numerical clutch and analytic clutch, some of which Steve was basing his work on, where the trajectories are either described via geodesic plus some sort of positronian flux, or in the Barak-Kattler way via some positronian expansion of differential equations that describe the evolution of your phases and so on. The gravitational waves are then constructed either via a multipolar decomposition, keeping maybe the quadrupole and the octuple terms, or via a Peterson-Matthews quadrupolar analysis only. But the thing to notice here is that there are many more purple things than blue things. And there's a reason for that, because clearly working on the cell force is much, much harder than working on approximation theories. Now, let's describe the EOB scheme in a little bit more detail. How do you describe the waveforms? As I said, these waveforms are obtained by inverting the Einstein operator, which you rewrite as a resummation on a multipolar decomposition, where I and J are here, say, the mass and the current multiple numbers. Now, what is that resummation in this EOB approach? Well, it's a product resummation. That means that instead of writing something as a sum of terms or as a pade, you write it as the product of several terms, each of which is resummed independently. The first term is a Newtonian expression for the waveform. The second term is a source-like term that appears on the right-hand side of the Ricci-Wheeler equation, for example. And you can think of it sort of like a binding energy. And the third term here is the so-called transfer or tail term that describes the relationship between moments defined in the near zone with moments defined in the far zone. And it accounts for all little leading order logarithmic corrections due to the backscattering of gravitational waves of the background curvature of space-time. Now, if you take those three terms and then you do a post-Newtonian expansion in B over C, you find that you don't get exactly back the good old waveform that you know and love from post-Newtonian. So in order to fix that, you introduce two fudge factors, the amplitude correction factor and a phase correction factor that are designed such that when this whole expression is expanded, you recover the correct answer in the far field limit. So those are the waveforms, and these depend on the trajectories. So now I need to tell you how we're going to evolve the trajectories. This we do via a Hamiltonian system. So essentially, we rewrite the evolution equations in terms of, x is a trajectory here of the particle, and p is a conjugate momentum to that trajectory. And they depend on the derivatives of the Hamiltonian of the system that's resummed in some specific way. Of course, if I were just to write a Hamiltonian system, it would be fully conservative, so the particles would remain in a geodesic. And in fact, this system was constructed such that in the point particle limit, this is exactly the Hamiltonian of Schwarzschild, or exactly the Hamiltonian of Kerr, so you had exactly the geodesic equations written in this form. But you want your particles to in spiral, so you add a radiation reaction force. And this radiation reaction force is constructed directly via the waveforms. So how do you do that? Well, the radiation reaction force can be related to the flux of energy, for example, for circular orbits in Schwarzschild, carried away by gravitational waves either to infinity or into the horizon. And that is nothing but the time derivative of the waveform squared. So knowing what the waveforms are, as given in the previous slide, one can plug that into this expression over here, and then into that, and solve this differential system. Now, I didn't write quite here the contribution due to horizon absorption, but this is critical to get good phase agreement. If you don't include the amount of waves that fall into the horizon, especially when you're dealing with orbits around Kerr, you're not going to get the right phase at all. It'll dephase real fast. So there's two alternatives here. You can use the system as I wrote it down without any calibration parameters and with a bunch of resummations. But I think the real strength of the EOB is as a fitting routine. So what you do is you add calibration parameters to the raw LM factors that I had shown earlier, and then you fit this, for example, to Scott's Tucholsky flux. And once you fit these parameters, they are fixed, and you just evolve your Hamilton equations, and you obtain your phases as they are. You don't do a secondary fit afterwards. Now, I'm not quite selling you a lemon, because here what we want is the best model that we can find that's accurate enough and fast enough. And there are many such fitted or fitting models. What seems to be nice about the EOB so far, at least in my experience, is that you need less parameters than if you were to calibrate just a Taylor model. So is this different from what other people have done? Well, clearly, yes. In the analytical or in the numerical clutch schemes, you are using some post-Newtonian expressions, but usually black hole absorption information is not included. But we're also, of course, doing something different from the full cell force, because after all, even though we are resumming and calibrating, we still, in some sense, are building our expressions for the fluxes and so on as from expressions that are finite order in B over C. So let me give you now some comparisons between the fluxes and the evolutions of the trajectories and the waveforms, or directly the waveforms, actually. So what I'm showing you here is the difference between the E of B flux and the Tucholsky flux as given by Scott, divided by the Tucholsky flux actually here. So the blue line is just using a Taylor expansion. So you see it grows with the velocity as it should, and this is for Schwarzschild, remember. And you reach about, you know, a little bit less than 10%, so like 5% or something like that. If you do an EOB resummation without any calibration parameters, it gets a little bit better, but not that much better at high velocities. What really does the trick is to calibrate this flux, which in this case we calibrated with two or four parameters. I don't remember precisely. And you get an agreement of one part in 10 to the 6. And by the way, this Scott's Tucholsky flux that's computed here has been checked to be correct up to 10 to the minus 13 or 10 to the minus 14. So now we've calibrated these parameters and we've fixed them, so we know what they are, so we can solve the Hamilton equations. We do so, then the trajectories, compute the waveforms, and now I'm gonna compare the gravitational wave phase of these waveforms. So for the tutu mode, for example, what we have here is just two different systems, one with mass ratio 10 to the minus 4 and one with mass ratio 10 to the minus 5. Again, what I'm showing you is the defacing, or the difference in the phase between Scott's Tucholsky waveform and the EOB waveform. So divided by the Scott's waveform. Or no, this is just a total difference, sorry. If you just use a Taylor expansion, you're gonna get defacings of, you know, 50 or so, or, you know, even thousands, depending on the mass ratio. If you do an EOB uncalibrated model, the defacing goes down quite a bit, but perhaps not enough for data analysis purposes. It's only when you calibrate this scheme that you get really good agreement, like, you know, 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 1 radians in 2 years of integration time. And if you were to just want a 1 month integration time, the agreement would be much better. Now this is all done. Oh, and for the data analysis in the audience, we have maximized over time of coalescence and phase of coalescence here, so it's not a, so there are some maximizations that happen. Now, the question is, can you do this for Kerr? Because for Kerr, it becomes much more difficult. Why? Because now your velocity at the ISCO can reach up to 0.7 for a maximally rotating black hole that's prograde. Velocities of 0.6, 0.7, the speed of light, are not much less than 1. And therefore, you might expect the post-Newtonian theory to break down. And in fact, even for this case, this is a spin of 0.8. You see here the difference between Scott's flux and the EOB flux, either using a Taylor expansion in the solid lines or the resumed expansion in dashed line. As the velocities get higher and higher, you know, greater than 0.5, then everything goes to hell, in some sense. The agreement is not that good. Furthermore, now it's harder to calibrate these models, because if you were to add a term that's like a coefficient times v to some power, that coefficient is not a number anymore, but it's a function of the spin. So what functional dependence on the spin do you choose? And in fact, we have seen that just fitting the non-spinning case first and then fitting the other ones is not really what you want to do here, because you're not predicting post-Newtonian parameters. What you want is to fit this coefficient such that the chi-square of this decreases, or the agreement of this increases the best you can. So you need to really do a bidimensional calibration. But we've done that. And for example, for the case of spin of 0.7, we find that adding four parameters gains you about a factor of 10 in agreement. And if you calibrate more parameters, you can bring these curves lower and lower. If I were to just take the Taylor and add 16 parameters, the curve would be where the blue curve is. Okay? So I was hoping I would be able to present faces as well for the Kerr case. This is circular and equatorial Henry's, but we haven't gotten that far yet, so I'm going to have to just leave you with this plot and conclude. The idea is that there are many approximate models that you can use for data analysis, not just the Barak and Cutler waves, and many of them are fast. Whether they are accurate or not remains to be seen. It's hard to assess. The one that we have studied is definitely fast. It takes like 5 CPU seconds to run one orbit on my laptop in mathematics. So not even the most efficient way to do things. Is it accurate? Maybe. We need some more accurate, more precise exact answer to be able to determine that. But it's definitely efficient because you're computing the waveforms and the trajectory simultaneously. Black hole absorption is critical if you want to get the phase right over a sufficiently long integration time, especially if you have memories about spinning black holes. And you know, as was expected, adding spin and making orbits more and more generic complicates things dramatically. So it remains to be seen whether this will succeed for the spinning case or not for more generic orbits. We're still working on that. And it remains to be seen how accurate any of these models that I presented in purple are relative to the self-force waveforms once Lior and Steve and Bernard and so on, Eric, give those to us. So I guess I'll conclude here and take any questions. I can't hear. It's a small what? Yeah. No, so this fitting is not done for a particular spin. It's done for all spins that we have data for, which ranges from minus 0.99 to 0.9, and as function of velocity for all those spins up to the ISCO. So the plot is representative of all spins that we have seen. So that plot holds for spin 0.6, 0.5. I mean, the curves change a little bit, but the overall worst agreement is order of magnitude the same. That's the key part. I mean, you don't want to fit a spin and then just calibrate and then be okay with that one, but not with the other ones. That's why it's so much harder. Well, as I was describing, we're using this product decomposition for the HLMs. Hamiltonian. Well, if we want to compare to Scott's data, you have to use a point particle approximation. You have to set all conservative mass ratio terms to zero because he doesn't have conservative corrections in his code. We can turn those on, and there would be a difference. Oh, we're using, we're using Enrico's and Alessandra's latest Hamiltonian. Yeah. Sorry.
So, Nico, just a semi-humorous comment and an actual question. So, the end there, you sort of say we have to choose, you know, either the path of good or the path of evil. I would actually say what we're kind of doing is we're much more like Boba Fett. I mean, there's no morality at all. We're just in it for trying to get whatever the whatever we can get out of it, and we're happy to borrow from good or evil, you know, however it happens to go. The other thing I want to say more seriously, though, is that I actually was a little scared by the number of parameters you're putting down there. The number of parameters is exploding exponentially, and we are still doing geometries that are, even though we've had it spin, the geometry is as simple as it gets.
Yeah,
and that ain't what Emery's look like. So
let me comment on that. You're absolutely right, but the key point here is that in the non-spinning case, we knew, so there's two contributions to the flux, okay? There's a contribution that goes to infinity and a contribution that goes to the horizon. In the non-spinning case, we knew what the flux was in the expansion in B over C up to order B over C to the 11 and B over C to the 12 for the infinity and black hole absorption. In the spinning case, the spinning contributions for the absorption are known up to B over C to the 12, I think, by the Japanese group. But for the infinity flux, it's only known up to B over C to the 8. So we're missing the V over C to the 9, the V over C to the 10, and V over C to the 11 relative to the Schwarzschild case. And those are the terms that you need to calibrate. Now, as far as I know, because you told me so, Fujita is calculating what the V over 9, V over 10, and V over 11 terms should be, because those should be relatively straightforward modulo algebra to obtain. And once those are known, then you don't need to calibrate 12 parameters. So in the 16 parameter case. So that would reduce to become four parameters again. And so that's good. The point is that we're here on calibrating parameters that will hopefully be known within a year.
Okay, I think with that we should close this morning session. So thanks again to Steve and Nico. Don't eat too fast, it's not healthy, but please eat fast enough so that we can resume at 1 p.m. here.